Hi everyone, welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Ruhrkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we have a fun episode planned because we'll be talking about two Oscar winners and two of the best science fiction movies, I would say, of all time. And maybe you agree, we will see. But we'll be talking about the original Alien from 1979 and Aliens from 1986.
I'm so excited to talk about both of these today. I agree with you. I think these are two of the greatest science fiction films of all time, and they're very different from each other, but I love them both. I feel like they each have their merits and really deserve their place in the canon of great science fiction, great horror, and in the case of Aliens, great action. And part of the reason why we're doing this is because Alien Romulus is coming out in just a few weeks, so we wanted to take the time to watch all of these movies. I'm excited to hear from you because I know you're a little ahead of me in getting through some of these. But Alien and Aliens, I can say definitely not only stand above other films in the genre, but stand above the other films in this franchise.
Yeah, this is a huge franchise. Going back to what you said already, at the end of the episode, we'll ask each other, what movie do you prefer? And I was trying to think of this question, and I'm like, I feel stupid saying this, but I'm like, these movies are so different from one another. Mm-hmm. Even though it's the same world, like, there are so many differences between how they were made and just the structure. And I think that's what's so exciting about them and why they're great movies to rewatch. The first crazy thing I'm going to say is that, and I'm curious about your introduction to this franchise and if you saw Alien first. My first introduction,
I'm so scared,
was with Alien versus Predator in theaters.
In 2004.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up watching the originals. I honestly think it would have been too scary of an experience. Mm-hmm. I feel like you've hinted at this before, but I remember watching it in theaters, that final shot, and we have this Predalien, which I didn't remember, but that's where that sequel, AVP Requiem, comes in and where they follow that. But I only recently saw Alien and Aliens for the first time in the past month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I didn't realize it had only been that recent. I think I assumed I had seen snippets of it before, but in its entirety, these were my first viewings, and I really enjoyed them.
Good. I'm so, so glad to hear that you enjoyed them. I don't think it's that weird that Alien versus Predator was your first introduction, just because I remember that being a big deal when it came out. My dad is a huge fan of Alien, so I saw that in theaters at the time, too. I would have been just 11, and that was my first of the franchise that I saw in theaters, even though I was introduced to Alien earlier.
Just talking about the releases and all the films related, there are canon films, which are the first four, and then everything else, I mean, everything else to Ridley Scott is basically not after Alien, but in terms of actual canon, it includes the first four. So Alien and Aliens, which we'll talk about today, Alien 3, which we covered on our Fincher episode when we talked about all of the movies that he had directed.
Yeah.
So Alien 3 from 1992, Alien Resurrection, 1997 by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, and then we have AVP Alien vs. Predator in 2004, Aliens vs. Predator Requiem in 2007. Those two are in the same timeline together. And then we got Prometheus in 2012 by Ridley Scott, and then Alien Covenant in 2017, also by Ridley Scott. So he kind of took over where he left off and made those final two movies as prequels in the universe that he saw that as. And we can talk about that today and how maybe he disagreed with James Cameron or was not included in that sequel and what he thought about that and where they took the ideas for the franchise from there. But there are a lot of movies, and I just recently watched all of them.
Wow.
Insane. Except for Requiem. I didn't get to that one, but all of the other ones, I didn't really expect them to get worse and worse over time, but that's what happened. And I think some of the ideas of what they're trying to do should have worked, but didn't. How many of these have you seen?
I was going to say, okay, I'll tell you that first. And then I do have a question about getting worse and worse. So I've seen Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3. I have not seen Alien Resurrection. I'm going to watch it before Alien Romulus, but I have been warned by many people that it's terrible. Just to brace myself.
Also me.
Also you. I've seen AVP, Alien versus Predator. I have not seen Requiem. And then I've seen Prometheus and Alien Covenant. I like Prometheus. I did not like Alien Covenant, but I did like Prometheus.
How recently have you watched Prometheus?
When it came out in theaters, so 2012.
I remembered liking it too, and then I watched it this week, and that went away.
Oh, wow.
So I'm curious if your rewatch would influence that. It's just some of the specifics of this being a prequel. It made me realize, like, it is a beautiful film. Cinematography by Darius Wolski, literally out of this world. There are just so many magnificent shots. But I felt like the story got so muddled. And maybe that's because there were so many other movies and ideas coming across by other directors that Scott wasn't directly a part of. And he kind of reined that in or did what he wanted in terms of the alien and maybe not wanting there to be this mother alien. And I just felt by the end, I was tired. The Fassbender character by the end and then him into Covenant, it was just too much. He's great as a villain. There was just too much information and different threads that I slowly backed away as I saw each new movie.
Okay. I am hearing I need to rewatch Prometheus because maybe 2012 me is different than 2024 me. I think that's very possible. I'm just on memory alone, though, I think surprised you didn't like Prometheus just because when I think back on that, it feels very similar to like Dune or Blade Runner 2049 in terms of the feeling and the world building and the look. But I haven't seen it in 12 years, so I could be mistaken.
I don't disagree about that. I think you'll understand if you watch, but I felt like the relationships and how the story ends, like between Elizabeth Shaw, the Noomi Rapace character, and David, the Michael Fassbender character, things just get weird. And I think because I had seen Alien and Aliens so recently that making the connection between them and then the fact that this is supposed to be a prequel, but everything looks so much more pristine and more advanced technologically than Alien and Aliens, because that was made in the past. It just, there are a lot of things that I got really messed up with watching it, and that took me out.
Okay.
Watch it again, and I'll be curious what you think.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm not looking forward to watching Alien Covenant again, though, because that is not one that I enjoyed.
So also with this is that Prometheus is the prequel. So that's coming before what we're talking about today. And then watch Resurrection, which comes after canonically. And then Alien Romulus takes place in between Alien and Aliens. But I think that'll give you a good timeline in terms of how things are happening in the world of this franchise.
I think so too. And it'll be interesting to see how Romulus pulls that off or how that works. Because if we think about the beginning of Aliens, which we'll talk about in a little bit, Ripley was aboard for 57 years. So we have a lot of time in between that this could take place in. Mm-hmm. And I have faith that we're not going to ruin everything with some sort of Ripley cameo, because it's just not possible. And I have seen clips and interviews already between Fede Alvarez, who's directing Alien Romulus, and Ridley Scott, and know that they're not going to do anything like this because it seems like they have a great amount of respect for each other and that they've been working a little bit together on this. Like, it's fully Fede Alvarez's vision, but Ridley Scott, I think, has been involved just in terms of consultations. And when I saw Alien in theaters a few months ago, they had a few interviews between the two of them talking about Romulus and talking about Alien. So I feel like we don't have too much to worry about, hopefully, and that Ridley Scott will be happy and we will be happy with it too.
Yeah, I think his stamp of approval would definitely not be there. If Sigourney Weaver made a cameo, and I checked IMDb, so far it's only the six actors I think that we've seen from the trailer. So we might be in the clear. There was that interview before Alien between those two that I really enjoyed before my viewing. Because again, I hadn't seen it before. And I think getting a mini introduction by Scott was really cool. And they talked about casting Sigourney. It was Warren Beatty who called him because he saw her off Broadway. I was like, whoa, hold up. Because she was really young. She filmed this at 28. She was the youngest of those crew members in her cast. And I think that was part of what was so different from movies of this at the time. And ultimately, she's the one that's carrying this original saga, if we want to call it that, the first four movies that she's in. And she's incredible at it. She was the first with Aliens, getting ahead of myself per usual. She was the first sci-fi actress nominee ever in that category.
Yeah.
So I think she pushed the boundaries in terms of sci-fi films, and she's known for it. Like, she is as important to this franchise as Jamie Lee Curtis is to Halloween.
Exactly.
It's amazing, and I would love to see her return. She's talked about it before, even though this isn't the time, but it's what we come back for as well.
I agree. I love Ripley as a character. And let's get right into Alien so we can keep talking more and more about her and everything that she has to put up with all of these men on board who will not listen to her. And we will be spoiling these movies. They've been around for quite some time now. So if you haven't seen them, please go watch them. We will be getting into, I would say, light plot spoilers. So if you don't want to hear that, pause the episode, watch these movies, and come back. So, Alien from 1979, description here. The crew of a spacecraft, Nostromo, intercept a distress signal from a planet and set out to investigate it. However, to their horror, they are attacked by an alien which later invades their ship. This was directed by Ridley Scott and stars Sigourney Weaver, Tom Skerritt, Veronica Cartwright, Harry Dean Stanton, John Hurt, and more. This was nominated for Best Art Direction, and it won Best Visual Effects. I loved this movie as an Oscar winner. So you mentioned that you watched this recently for the first time. How did you feel about it? And I want to know this in particular because your first viewing was in a theater. That's the prime way to watch this. So what did you think?
I was waiting for these to be in theaters, especially with the new movie coming out and us planning to talk about them. Aliens, unfortunately, wasn't showing up anytime soon, so I watched that at home. But Alien was incredible. Again, we got that intro by Scott and Alvarez. And starting out, it has these Star Wars vibes. Blade Runner, obviously, that he directed. I saw that at the Paris last year. You know, that opening title sequence that is so eerie. And just getting to see it, how it was supposed to be watched in a theater, incredible sound. I really didn't know what I was getting into at first. I think being a 70s movie, but also being well known as one of the best of all time, I had pretty high expectations, but I was never disappointed. I was scared along the way. It was a thrilling experience. It is a slow burn, though I can understand why you love it so much. But that's part of the intensity of the movie, is that it slowly reels you in, and then you see what these aliens look like, or the eggs, or the embryos, and the face huggers, and then you start to realize what's going to happen to the ship and that people are dying. So it's a journey, and then once you're there, it ratchets up, and that final sequence where she has to leave the ship, it's like, oh my God, there's a countdown going on, and it's a race against time. So you're feeling so many emotions during this movie. I mean, it's phenomenal. It's beautiful. The set pieces, they pushed this movie. There were problems during this and Aliens. No one really liked Scott or Cameron as directors, mostly the crew because of their visions. And again, this being so different from anything audiences had seen before. So I think it's such an accomplishment. And I think one that I'm going to return to time and time again, especially during Halloween season.
I'm so glad to hear that. My history with this movie is very strange, so I'm going to just preface this all by saying I was a very weird child, and I had a toy xenomorph that my dad gave me when I was like 6 or 7 years old that I would play with. It was this little action figure, and you would push a button on the back and the mouth would shoot out. And I loved that thing. I would take it everywhere. And we also, I'm really revealing a lot. I'm so sorry. We also, at the mall, I remember, had this store, Sharper Image. And in Sharper Image, there was a huge xenomorph, specifically the queen from Aliens. Huge. Maybe, I think it was probably like 6 feet tall. But I, every time we would go to the mall, had to go visit the xenomorph. So I was just never scared of this creature because it was a toy first for me. Like, my dad just thought it would be funny to give me this action figure. I need to ask my mom because I know there are probably pictures somewhere of like 6-year-old me carrying around this alien. I wonder what people thought, honestly, of that. They were probably scared, worried for my future. But yeah, so I love Alien very much. It's always had like a really important place, I think, in my history as someone who loves film. But I didn't watch it maybe until middle school for the first time all the way through. And I remember certain images really sticking with me. But you said this for me about Ordinary People, and I wonder if you're going to feel similarly now when I say that Alien is a comfort movie for me. It is one I return to pretty frequently just because it reminds me of growing up and my family. And it also is something that I feel like I just settle into the rhythm of it very easily. And I really love how you can either watch it as this genre piece, as this slow burn sci-fi horror thriller, or you can take it a step deeper and you can really dig into these complex themes around capitalism and human identity and existence and how we feel about what we're doing in this world and who cares about us and whether or not our companies care about us. Is it all futile in the end? Right? Like, it makes you think, I think, about how you process fear and what you would do in situations like that. So I like that you can really enjoy it no matter what type of experience you're looking to have at the movies. So Alien, like I said, very important film to me. But Aliens, I actually didn't see until the pandemic, until COVID. I was home. My parents were shocked that I had never seen Aliens. So we watched it. And I just remember the first thing my dad saying was, it is very different from Alien. It is action-packed the whole way through. But I really enjoyed it too, even though it's different. And we'll get into more specifics later when we review that one. But Alien, yeah, it's a masterpiece. Full stop.
Going back to this action figure and this life-size model, this wasn't the 80s. So I'm curious, was this like post-Alien 3? Like, was this a McDonald's toy that came after that movie? Or they had something from one of the first two?
I think, if I'm thinking of it, it would be from Alien 3 or Alien Resurrection. Because it would have been, I mean, I was 4 in 1997. So it was probably like right after that when I started becoming obsessed with this thing. But I think that, I don't know, my dad had a lot of them that were a bit older too, okay, that I could play with. But this one was mine in particular. So I don't know. I'll have to ask about when they purchased it and why. I don't know the answer to that. But I would say that the large alien, the xenomorph, was probably because of, if I'm thinking of the timing right, Alien Resurrection. But imagining it as a McDonald's toy is even funnier than the fact that I had the action figure. Like, the poor children that would open a Happy Meal box and there would be this terrifying creature inside.
Yeah, I mean, the horror that they would open up and find this monster. But I also wouldn't put it past McDonald's. Like, this movie is all about this company sending these people basically to die so that they can bring home this alien, mm-hmm, and study how it functions and use it as a weapon. And that's really what companies are doing to this day. So
yeah,
I say that in jest, but honestly, I'm sure kids, teenagers, young adults would go get Happy Meals and do that. It's kind of surprising to me that all four of these movies had similar box office returns, Alien and Alien slightly more than 3 and Resurrection. But again, that's more the reason to have merchandise out there and different sponsorships. And I partly also ask this too, because the design of the aliens are a little different, and we have different creatures throughout the different movies. So we have newborns in Resurrection. I mentioned the Predalians in AVP, Neomorphs in Alien Covenant. So it's like this expansive genealogy of these aliens. And I'm curious if they were just all the same in terms of design, or if like your little one was different than the life-size one. I'm sure you still have it somewhere.
The next time I go to Ohio, I'll take a picture of the little one because I still have it. But on that note, at the Grove in LA, at that AMC, I've seen pictures of, they have a huge xenomorph.
Wow.
In a case to promote Romulus, and it looks similar to the one I remember. So if there are any parents out there listening and your children want to go see this.
Don't go to the Grove.
This giant thing at the Grove. Let me know if they're not scared of it.
I think what I like more about these original movies, and specifically here, is that they made it a point to not show the alien in full. And they maybe only do once or twice near the end of the movie. And I think that's what's so exciting about viewing it, even if it's your second or third time, because we only see different versions, like I said, of the life cycle. So we have the face hugger, we have the egg really early on when Kane is on that ship and inspects it, and then they bring him back. And then from there, one of my favorite scenes, when we have that first chest bursting scene with him. And then later on, when they're chasing the alien again, I mean, at this time, they don't call it a xenomorph. We don't get that until Aliens, but we only see bits of it. And I think maybe the first time we do see most of it is when Dallas is searching the ship and he turns his flashlight and we see it really quickly. And that moment is so scary. So that's part of the intensity of it, is they knew how to reveal it to audiences so that it would be this really exciting built up moment that people were expecting their worst nightmare to be around the corner.
Yeah. What I love about Alien 2 is how it opens, how we learn a little bit about Nostromo, we learn a little bit about the crew, but we're basically just getting a tour of the ship. There aren't any humans yet. It's very dark. The camera's really slow. We have this Jerry Goldsmith score. Remember, he also did Chinatown. And it's very eerie. And it feels like it's haunted. It feels like something bad already happened there, or you get this premonition that something bad is about to happen. And when we meet the humans on board and they're emerging from those pods, they feel alien, right? But it's also really beautiful, like that room being all white. It feels like this very peaceful moment, one of the few peaceful moments that we have in the movie. So to start that way, it already puts you on the wrong foot. You're thinking it's going to be a different type of movie maybe than it is in that part. And then immediately when they're eating breakfast together after they've been sleeping for months, we have this Altman-style crosstalk at the table. And Ridley Scott was inspired by a number of directors and other films. This movie was marketed as Jaws in Space. And he was also inspired by Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Altman, like I mentioned. But we have this here, crosstalk. They're overlapping as they're talking to each other. But what I love about these characters is that they feel like real humans. These people aren't the heroes that we're used to when we watch space movies. I think a lot of times when we watch space movies, they're decorated astronauts. They're trying to save the world. They have some great mission ahead of them. And here, they're on a cargo ship, and they are motivated by money, a few of them. They're asking, like, when will we get paid? Will we get a share of this? So that also makes it more real to me and makes them also feel like cogs in the machine of this corporation. And the best part about Alien to me, in the way that the corporation interacts, is that we don't see any of them on board. They're safely on Earth, and they've sent these people out to put themselves in harm's way to bring this creature back. We, of course, have Ash, who ends up being an android, but we don't see any of the, you know, bigwigs or the higher-ups from the company on the ship. They're not risking their lives for this. They just want the power and the reward. And these people are unknowingly tasked with putting themselves in this horribly dangerous situation. And it just reminds you, again, for anyone listening, your job does not care about you. It's a good reminder to always have.
Yeah, I totally agree. And part of the company, you know, through the movies, it changes. We see Wayland at certain points and their intentions change. But here, yeah, we're getting those computer messages from Mother about the company. And that's one of the big twists later on. So it's giving the audience little bits of information along the way. And I think it's the right amount because it's enough for us to keep moving on without having too many questions about the setting. Like you said, we're initially introduced to the ship, to the entire crew. And I also love that Sigourney Weaver, who we know is the vision of the movie, isn't the immediate standout. She's not the captain. She's just one of the crew. She's like a deckhand who doesn't go on the expedition. She can read the distress signal and she's interpreting it. And she's like, I think this is a warning, not an SOS call. So she is really smart. Yeah, I love that. We don't have any idiots here. And I think that's also my problem, is that like the crew members just get dumber and dumber over time. And it just distills into this bad horror movie trope or writing. And here it's just, we're kind of on their playing field in terms of understanding this. So being on this new planet, seeing that ship on almost like a VHS screen where it's all hazy and staticky, that adds to the eeriness of this expedition.
Well, didn't you love the fact during that little pre-show before Alien, when Ridley Scott talked about how they filmed that, how he played that on a TV and then shot it? The creativity back then, right? Like not relying on CGI, so much of this movie, it's just the impeccable set design and the practical effects and just thinking creatively like that, and how he wanted them to look so small when they touched down that, like, he put his kids in those little spacesuits and had them walking out. That is just, again, it's those sorts of things that make you realize, like, masterpieces don't necessarily happen because everything was going perfectly according to plan on set. Sometimes it is being just really inventive and thinking, okay, how can I make the audience feel this particular way? Oh, I'm going to make sure that, like you said, it feels really eerie when you're watching that crackling screen. Or if the crew feels really small on this set, it's going to make you realize how vast everything is out there in space and how they're in way over their heads. But I agree. I like your point about how we're on an even playing field with them, because even though you can get frustrated by some of the crew members, they're not stupid, right? Like they're just trying to do the best they can with being forced into this situation. Because how frustrating would it be though if you're on your way home and you have to go off course?
Absolutely.
I get so anxious when this happens in the movie, because you know, like, even if you're on a trip, I don't know, to another state and you're at the airport and your flight gets delayed, I get so annoyed. I just think, oh, I just want to get home. I just want to sleep in my own bed tonight. But if you're in a spaceship and all of a sudden you're months away from home because you decide to go off course, oh my God. But I was going to ask you, so when they go, after they detect the transmission, they go investigate and they land, and Kane ends up in what is one of the scariest, most beautiful scenes in the movie, when he all of a sudden sees all of those eggs, and then the face hugger flies out of that egg and attaches itself to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you let him back in? What is your reaction? Because I think that this is a very realistic issue of people having empathy for a crew member wanting to bring him back in, or on the other hand, just saying, absolutely not. We have protocol here. I'm not bringing this thing on board.
It is a tough question, and it's one that I asked myself on rewatch. You have to follow the chain of command at that time, and that is Ripley. And she says no, and honestly, her saying no makes this movie better. And it doesn't necessarily turn Ash into a villain yet, but again, on rewatch, everything that he does, every cut to him, shows that he's a droid and that he is the villain. But I think at this point, you know, why not let the other two in and leave him in the airlock for the 24 hours? Every person has their own motivations in this moment, and that's why it's so complicated. Again, Ash lets them in because he knows the directive to save the life forms and to bring it on board and bring it home. But I think you have to side with Ripley in saying no. Knowing what's going to happen to the ship by the end, what, four of them could have survived? It's a tough call, but again, I think it's a character-building moment for Ripley to stand up to everyone, especially being a woman running this ship now and putting her foot down.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree, actually. I think that, not to make this dramatic, but it is very empowering, I think, to see Ripley as a character say no, take charge, stand her ground, and remain really calm in the face of all this pressure and fear. And yet, at the same time, it is so real that no one listens to her. That, I think, just has to happen in this story. It has to happen in Aliens because it is actually how that character would be treated, I think, in a situation like she's in both movies, that she's the one who is following protocol or who knows the experience, and yet they completely disregard her. And what's interesting here, Ray, is the fact that they use this idea of empathy and, you know, making a decision with your heart instead of your head as a way to undermine her or claim that they're making the better decision is a really interesting theme in the movie. And I absolutely just would have said, no way, he is not coming in here. We're following protocol. It's just like how I think I told you this with when I saw Longlegs. Longlegs could have never gotten me because I'm too afraid of nuns and dolls. Like, there are just certain things that if some stranger comes to your house and wants to come in, you say no. You keep the door closed. You pretend not to be home. You don't tempt fate and let things in that shouldn't be in your world. Now, I know we wouldn't have a movie if everyone listened to Ripley, but I would have. She knew what she was talking about.
Yeah, and this isn't just the first two. This is Alien 3. This is Alien Resurrection. It's something that I wish they could innovate in some way in the screenplay to do this and to maybe surprise us. And maybe I'm hoping this happens with Romulus. But with the egg and the design and that first moment with Kane, I love that shot where it's backlit and we're kind of seeing into the egg. Part of, I think, why this movie stands the test of time is because of the effects being all practical. And just reading about now everything that happened behind the scenes and how they accomplished these things. This was shot in post-production with a fiberglass egg, again, with that really cool lighting that I love that you can see in there, which apparently was Scott and his hands like moving around. So it's learning about how they make these things, not only in making your stomach churn, but I think even if I had seen this today in a movie, I would still be creeped out by it. So it's these things that just stick out in your memory for how inventive they were. And this goes to the facehugger design and how it wraps around his neck and tightens and how they scan him. I mean, they're doing from here on out all of the things that you would want them to do. I don't know about how wearing masks and working on him in the same room, you know, really protects yourself from anything that could happen. But, you know, it's seeing them try to cut off the finger and then seeing that acid blood. And immediately they're like, it's going to rip through the hull. We need to go investigate. So I think the action, not that I don't see this as an action movie, even though it's more body horror, but they're doing all the right things from here on out. And that I appreciate in the movie going experience too.
Yeah, it's the really impressive thing too that does remind me of Jaws a little bit is that we don't see the face hugger and then the chest bursting scene until about 40 minutes into the movie. So they do this really good job of creating this slow burn, this great world building. We're getting to know our characters and it's slowly scaring us. And then from the time that we see the chest bursting scene on, that's when it becomes a thriller, when it becomes a bit more action packed. But I love the pacing. I would understand, I think, if people did find it too slow, but that makes it an even stronger film for me. So our MVP here of the movie potentially is this guy, H.R. Giger, who is an artist and who is our creature designer. Ridley Scott saw his artwork and the studio itself thought that his work was a little bit too much for audiences and for this movie in particular, but Ridley Scott completely disagreed. He thought, this is exactly what I need for my movie. And the more and more that you read just about how these designs were created and the inspiration for them and what they used, like you talking about the fiberglass egg, but the idea that the face hugger mm-hmm. was made of a sheep's intestine and then shot out of the egg using an air hose. That's, again, like they're not doing that today because they don't have to. So they're not thinking, okay, how can we do this and make it look really terrifying, but also as realistic as possible. And I think what's so scary about the face hugger is when Kane is just laying there once they've brought him in and he's completely still, but sweating profusely. And we can just see that tail that's wrapped around his neck just tightening. That is so, so scary to me. It's just such an unsettling image. And then again, the fact that when they try to cut off one of its fingers, it basically just bleeds acid. So they know this is an otherworldly thing. It's really dangerous. But even scarier than that, we don't see the face hugger leave him. We just get this memo that they have to go see what's going on with Kane. It's like, come take a look at this. And it's gone. Again, it just these little things, we don't see too much until we need to. And I think that's a really effective way to build tension. And then I think the chest burster scene really is one of the all-time great moments of body horror in film history. The way everything seems fine with him and they're getting ready to go to bed. It's like they have their last supper before everything goes to hell and back. And then as he bleeds and then it shoots from his chest mm-hmm. and we see those gnarly metal sharp teeth. Oh my God. And the way it runs away too, it scurries away. Oh, it is so, so scary. I love it. I love the creature design. And that also, again, I always have to point out my nerdy art history facts, was inspired by Francis Bacon's three studies for figures at the base of a crucifixion. So again, they're thinking about these very bizarre British paintings that are very disturbing, but I would never think of connecting a sci-fi film and a creature design to a Francis Bacon painting. That is just, again, such a brilliant idea for it. And I love how that scene works and it just propels us into the rest of the film.
And I love that the chest bursting scene, the cast wasn't really told about what was going to happen. And when it popped out of his chest, like he's partially under a table. So this thing is coming out of the table, but they didn't know what that was going to look like. It was done in one take. Veronica Cartwright, who plays Lambert, was so shocked she became hysterical. She like freaked out because all this blood got over her and she didn't know that was going to happen. But these are the reactions that play the best in a movie like this. And I love facts like that. I also thought you would like with the egg, the light effects were done mm-hmm. because on the set next to them was The Who, the rock band. So they borrowed lasers from them to create this effect.
I love that. Oh, that's a great detail. You're right. I didn't know that either.
You know, filming at Pinewood Studios in England, but then they had other things. They used or the android's innards. This is insane. They used milk, caviar, pasta, fiber optics, and fully urinary catheters. So that when we see Ash in the end, and he's just cut, like his whole face is covered in this like thick milk. It's so eerie. Yeah.
It's so gross.
I mean, another great shot is when Ripley is beating him up, bangs his head. We see her with a drip of blood, this like really deep crimson blood. And we see him. And from this close up, that drip of white comes down. And we know that he's not human.
Yeah.
Like that, it just, it's such a simple thing that makes it even weirder than you could have expected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I love that detail about what he's made of, because it is so disgusting. The insides, you can see the fiber optics and those little bulbs. Like, it's such a strange scene. And also when they light him on fire and how he melts away, I think is so great. I did want to bring up one more thing about the chest burster scene that I thought about this time that I think is an interesting read on it. So I've always thought of this scene as a sci-fi horror childbirth. It just always made me think of that. Like, it's a birth scene of this terrible creature that's been growing inside of Kane. And I read that Dan O'Bannon, the screenwriter, he actually equated the facehugger to a depiction of assault, the facehugger, and then that being what impregnates Kane effectively. And then that chest hugger scene, which kills him, is a birth. And he wanted men to experience the horror of that in film, which I had never really thought about before. So even though I thought about it as this horrific birth, I hadn't really, I think, thought about it on the level as being an allegory for assault. Again, like I said at the beginning, you can read more into the movie if you wish. Like, you can look at those themes and think about them, or you can just appreciate it, right, as this really terrifying moment of body horror.
Absolutely. More about Geiger's designs. There are just so many sexual overtones that you were hinting at. And just reading the layers of what this means, like how the story works in that way. Like them walking through this spaceship that is apparently like two penises back to back. And they're walking through that. So they're the sperm. And then they go into this chamber where the eggs are. And then they're fertilizing those eggs with the face hugger. It's like, what? But it does in a way make sense, because the designs, again, by Geiger, you look at that alien head and that's exactly what it is. It's this phallic instrument. And something that Dan O'Bannon said, the screenwriter, who also credits the chest bursting to his Crohn's disease, which is just such a great metaphor for that as well.
Yeah, like a chronic illness. Yeah.
Yeah. And he also said that he literally called it like the act of that face hugger implanting the egg down your throat. Terrifying.
Yeah.
Just in that sense. But they called it homosexual oral rape. Like, these people.
The 70s were a different time.
Truly a demented sense of something happening. Exactly. But also with the face hugger, it has that tail, but it has those appendages that look like fingers, and it also is meant to look vaginal, just like the alien's mouth and how it's like dripping this white fluid.
Yeah.
So it's, again, like you said, really cool effects. But if you want to see it in a different way, there you go.
There you go. Yeah, I always
can't unsee it now.
No, sorry, everybody. Can't unsee it. And when they're looking at the face hugger, like when it's dead or like kind of loose, lightly breathing, that is completely a yonic symbol to contrast to when the xenomorph grows, the phallic symbol of its head. Yeah. Again, sorry, everybody. Now you can't unsee it when you watch Alien. But that's what they were going for with this production design and creature design.
But then also the mouth of how that second mouth comes out of the grown alien. Yeah. So I think this Oscar win is just totally deserved.
Yeah. I agree. And in addition to all of the symbolism around biology and around sex, there's a lot of symbolism around existentialism and death that comes directly from Francis Bacon's work. So if you look at any of his work in particular, but specifically the painting that we referenced earlier, which is at the Tate in London, if you want to go see it, his works are really difficult, I think, to pin down. But there's a lot of darkness, a lot of bleak imagery in his works, despite having sometimes really bright or vibrant colors to them. So like reds and oranges, which the film stays away from, but the shapes that we find in his work, we see in Alien. And that connects, I think, really nicely to those themes of the period in art that he's working in, and really his own distinct style. And even though it's an influence, Alien, what Geiger did here and team, they've created something that, yes, is based on previous films and previous art, but that is wholly original. I think this might be the greatest work of creature design in any sci-fi movie. Certainly the most iconic.
I really do think this is my favorite movie monster. It just creeps you out every time you see it, especially in any other movie in this franchise. It's just scary to look at. It will cause nightmares.
I agree. I think my favorite movie monster too. And another detail that I think is so scary that I'm so glad they included is that when Harry Dean Stanton's character goes looking for Jonesy, the cat, and we know the alien is on the ship, the chest burster, he's escaped, he's somewhere, he finds the skin that the alien has shed. So we know just from seeing that it's gotten bigger. Before we actually see how big it's gotten, we see that gross, like, it's like snake skin, like it's a reptile. And that's a sign that he's shedding his layers, or she's shedding her layers and growing in size and stature.
The design of the movie itself. So we're talking a lot about the alien. It's these biomechanical, organic characteristics. I think just contrasts so perfectly with the industrial spacecraft, especially in that scene when we have all of those chains dangling that cause these eerie sounds, you know, the clanking of them hanging. And because of how it's shot, you're looking around, you're trying to see motion because you're scared watching this, and you're scared for Brett, maybe a little bit. Again, I have my thoughts on Tabby Cats, just like A Quiet Place.
Okay, we need to talk about this because I had a whole section relating Jonesy to A Quiet Place day one.
On Cats. But he's still a liability on this ship. Mm-hmm. He can hide great. I mean, comparison with the monsters from A Quiet Place is that they can see motion. So it's not just one sense. But I do like how Jonesy maneuvers through the ship, like through the floorboards or the walls or just these little tiny crevices. I don't dislike him. It's definitely not how I thought about watching A Quiet Place day one. But again, in this scene, I love that he's hissing. Like there's something mm-hmm. wrong. There's something in the room that shouldn't be there. So that cues you in. And then when you see movement apart from the chains and this dark lighting and there's fog, you see the alien moving. And that's when you know. So I think it just builds really nicely on itself.
One of the most relatable qualities that Ripley has is that she goes back for Jonesy. The way she's flinging him around in that carrier always makes me laugh. I love Jonesy. I absolutely would have saved him. He is a textbook orange cat, which they're crazy. Those orange tiger cats, like they have personalities of their own. So it makes sense that he is just running wild, scaring everyone because he's setting off their little tracker and he won't get in the carrier when she's looking for him. She's trying to find him. And when he finally gets in, though, I'm very happy. And I always worry that she's going to forget him, even though I've seen it many times. So I am all for Jonesy the cat. I actually would love to get an orange cat and name it Ripley. That's always been on my cat list, but my cat's an only child, so I don't think it would work out too well in my apartment. But I love that Jonesy is alongside Ripley, the final girl, mm-hmm. in the end. And there's that really scary moment, too, where Jonesy's in the carrier and sees the alien.
Right, which is just a great ending. Again, with the timer and counting down, I mean, it's a little silly that she essentially wastes the entire timer in going back to get him and then counting down from 3, 2, 1, and it doesn't work. But yeah, it's all about the intensity. The editing really works. And even though she goes back, it's a great third act. I loved also reading that they really had to add on to shooting days because he proposed this fourth act of them escaping in the shuttle and then the alien being there. So you're not off the hook yet. And his initial ending is that the alien was to bite off Ripley's head and then make the final log entry in her voice. But the producers were like, this is too scary. This is too much. And they thought that the alien should die at the end. And I can understand from there on out why Scott was hesitant for there to be a sequel or to be attached to anything else. But that's what continues the journey. That's what brings Sigourney back and allows you to have more to this world. I mean, I appreciate a dark ending. I love that. But I also like the ending that we have.
I love Ripley so much as a character, again, that to imagine that ending is really difficult because I just love cheering her on the whole time, but especially at the end, like when she blasts it out into space and it is clinging on for dear life and she has just outsmarted it. That's the thing, is like she's not just relying on weapons, which we'll definitely talk about with aliens. She's relying on her brain and how she's, you know, thinking about where she is and how she can defeat this thing. So I love the ending that we have. I think it is a perfect ending. But it's funny you say that because when I was watching it this time, I was thinking, you know, in the 70s, does it make more sense for her to die at the end, to have this really bleak, I think I was thinking about Chinatown, really dark, harsh ending where this alien is the only thing left on the spaceship. All of these workers were completely expendable, right? Like that message from Mother says, crew expendable. Yeah. And I think it does make sense. But I'm very happy that we have the ending that we have.
Being a 70s movie, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's probably some middle ground in there from her head being ripped off and her surviving and the alien dying. But
yeah,
I definitely agree that they made the right choice. I think from here on out and how the rest of the movies end, again, they aren't quite innovative all the time, but I do like that the end here, this is Ripley, last surviving member of the Nostromo, signing off, and we have that shot of her going into her little chamber for hypersleep, which is the same ending from Alien 3. So I like that as a callback, but it's also just an iconic ending. You know, that line alone is so memorable.
I agree. And that shot of her, it takes you back to the beginning of the movie when they were all sleeping. It takes you, I think, to other science fiction movies, too. It made me think a lot about 2001. I think it's a similar type of image that Kubrick gives us there. So, yeah, I love the ending. Before we move on to Aliens, if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
My Oscar definitely has to go to visual effects. Geiger and his team just really created, again, a movie monster that is totally unforgettable, one of the scariest of all time. I think for this time, the scariest thing that anybody had seen, and just really inventive, bringing all of these elements together and having a purpose to them, I think is really important too. One that makes sense for the world and one in its development that is not only scary, but imaginable. Like the fact that something like this could be out there, why not? And that's something that I've enjoyed in my watching, is that, like, I don't want to go in space. No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be detoured into some planet to discover something new. I'm good. You know, this is one of the most violent creatures and deaths that we've seen. And appreciating its craft is something that I will revisit these movies for. What would your Oscar be for?
I'm also going to go with visual effects. I think that you said it really well, of how they make you feel, the way that this team, led by Geiger, really thought of how to scare audiences and not only create something new, but they created some of the most everlasting, iconic designs that we have in all of science fiction. And I think it is impossible to watch a science fiction movie that came out after Alien without seeing the influence of Alien, primarily from the visual effects team and their perspective. So that's my Oscar.
Amazing. We'll see if we match on Aliens. So mm-hmm. The next film from 1986. Description here. Ellen Ripley is sent back to the planet LV-426 to establish contact with a terraforming colony. Once there, she encounters the alien queen and her offspring and has to fight them to survive. This one was directed by James Cameron and it stars Sigourney Weaver again, Michael Biehn, Carrie Henn, Paul Reiser, Bill Paxton, Lance Henriksen, and more. This won Best Sound Effects Editing and Best Visual Effects and was also nominated for Best Actress for Weaver, Art Direction, Film Editing, Original Score, and Sound. So, way more nominations. I think by this point, audiences and the Academy had bought into this world and, you know, science fiction developing over time. I think the nomination for Weaver is the most shocking, I think, for a movie like this. But just on my watch, I have to say I love James Cameron movies, maybe more than I think I do. I really want to watch The Abyss, but his style, how action-packed this movie is just gripping. There's really nothing not to love here. And this made just under what Alien made at the box office. But I think before we get too much into it, what do you think about Aliens and maybe briefly how you feel about it compared to Alien?
So, like I mentioned at the top, I watched this for the first time in 2020. So much later than I had seen Alien. And I think I had avoided it just as a purist, not wanting to watch some of the sequels, knowing that the prequels I had watched, I did not love. And I'm not a big action movie person either. And for me, Alien is this perfect exercise in terror. It's a monster movie. It's a sci-fi horror film that is patient and rewards patience. And sometimes action movies can be the complete opposite. They can be big, dumb fun. And I think I assumed that that's what Aliens was. To some extent, it is. But I really love this movie. I think it's really successful as an action movie and in continuing this franchise and Ripley's story. It basically just takes the same sort of premise as the first one. Like, we have very similar themes working for us here. We have the way that Ripley interacts with everyone, how she is very clear in what she believes and in her demands, and people still will not listen to her. But what it does is it just, I think, ups the stakes on a more literal and obvious level. And literalizing and making things more obvious, that's not always a problem. You can still have fun with that. It just takes what they do in the first movie and it reinvents it a little bit. It just makes it bigger and louder. And I think, again, more action-packed from the jump. But because it's James Cameron, it works. I think he's the reason, along with Sigourney Weaver, why the movie works as well as it does. Because you have Sigourney Weaver delivering one of the great Best Actress nominated performances, because it's very inspired. And at the time, she's really the only person who could have done this. If you look at action movies from the time, who's driving people to the box office? Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. There aren't women except for Sigourney Weaver. And that's really cool. And I think she, in addition to just being incredibly strong and powerful physically in these movies to make you believe that she can fight the xenomorph, that she can fight the queen, she gives, I think, a really layered emotional performance too, where we understand her at every turn. And because James Cameron is such an emotional director, and I mean that that's complimentary, his action scenes and sequences always make me emotional. I think that the way he choreographs them around character and the just sheer drama to them, I love that. I don't think there are many other directors who can do what he does. And I think that works perfectly in concert with Weaver's performance. So, you know, again, is it literal and cheesy at times and obvious? Yes. Is it maybe unbelievable that she would go back to the scene of the crime to fight after all that she'd been through? Yes. Is it still incredibly enjoyable? Of course. So I'm a big fan.
If you're saying this is literal, again, just wait for Resurrection.
I'm scared.
That's what I have to say about that. I don't think it's too literal. I really do enjoy how he made this his own, even though the story is pretty much the same. Like you're saying, I think introducing this theme of motherhood was the thing I was shocked about most. And making that work, too, not only with the alien and the xenomorph, but introducing this character, Newt, this little girl, as a survivor of this attack. And obviously, Ripley is right. She says, hell no, I'm not going back there. Do you know what happened? And because it's been 57 years, that was the first shock of the movie. I said, oh my God, what a time jump.
Yeah, it's like Interstellar.
This isn't a normal sequel we're getting where it follows directly after. I mean, it does for her character because she's been asleep for that long. But no one else believes her because she's the only person to have gone through this. And that's another great character detail in her arc that makes us trust her, believe her, want her to succeed even more. So that being the impetus for the story and for her to go back, because she relents and she wants to save these people, despite the billions of dollars, again, that this company has poured into this settlement on this planet, which she doesn't care about, and no one honestly should care about except for Burke. So that's kind of his first villainous characteristic that we get. But finding this little girl, again, playing off of Jonesy in the first movie, when we hear these rustling sounds and not knowing what that is, now it's a girl, and the way that their bond forms is organic, is really uplifting and heartwarming for Jonesy and Ripley going back for Newt, because Newt supports her by the end also. And I think, again, that relationship arc, I bought into it. I loved it. I love that she went back for her in the end. So I think this movie plays on the best of Alien and that movie's tropes and how that works, but takes it in a totally new direction.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's funny because I never find myself as attached to Newt as I do to Jonesy. I'm not sure what that says about me, that I prefer the cat to the little girl, but that's fine. I do think that she's very effective, though, in the movie, and I agree. I buy the relationship between Ripley and Newt, especially because they are in similar situations, right? Like, Ripley was the last surviving member of her crew. No one believes her. Newt, she's the last surviving member of her crew, just in a different way. So it makes sense that these orphans find each other. And I think that's kind of beautiful that they team up together in that way. And of course, because she's a child, that just means that she's a liability in the same way that the cat is. And there are a number of very scary scenes with her where you know that Cameron isn't going to kill the child. Like, you know that's not going to happen. But there are some close calls that are very, very well shot. And I think in another way that this is more of an 80s movie than a 70s movie, in addition to the pacing, is that, like I said, for Alien, we don't have the corporation on board, right? It's just this crew. The corporation's on Earth. But here, we have this Burke character who's the villain, not Ash, right? Like, we have someone who is from the corporation on board, telling people they can trust him. But then we know he's just working for Weyland Yutani, this company. And we have the military also on board. We have the Marines, which means that there are a lot of guns, a lot of weapons. The firepower used in this movie is just extreme. And again, takes it into that fully action space, whereas the first one, not so much. They weren't really able to defend themselves as much as they thought they could, I think. I mean, there were definitely weapons in Alien, but here, it's on another level. And I think, like you said, with the first one, where we feel like we're on an even playing field with our crew, here, I don't feel that. I feel very irritated with these Marines because they will not listen to her. She's been through it, and no one believes her until it's too late. But I do want to shout out Bill Paxton here, who we talked about last week on our Twisters episode, because I love his performance as Hudson. I think he's fantastic. He's a great supporting performer here.
Something I didn't mention with Alien about the weapons is that we're also immediately introduced to the fact that, you know, with the acid ripping through the metal, they're like, you can't fire a weapon at this thing because it's going to blow us up, going to ruin the ship. So I think that's a really important and cool detail that we get immediately, where it's like, oh crap, they have to improvise. Mm-hmm. And then they use these flamethrowers. So here, I feel the same way. Even though they're Marines, I don't trust them because they're not trusting of Ripley. And they're so chaotic.
Yeah.
You know, they have all this like bro energy going on. You see one of the women immediately doing pull-ups once they get out of their hypersleep. And they're like, oh, I got to lift, bro. Like, it's too much for me.
Oh, I got to lift, bro.
I totally get it. And I understand their characters. And on the flip side to that is that they're almost comic relief in a way, which is something we didn't mention with Alien either, that I loved. There's one line where Lambert is out and they're walking and she goes, I can't see a goddamn thing. And Dallas goes, quit griping. She's like, I like griping. I'm like, oh, that's me. I relate to that.
That is good. I did love that line too.
Yeah. My favorite line. And here we get some of the same thing with the captain. You know, we have some really funny lines in this movie that make me want to cheer for it even more. The characters and just the movie in general and the action. But it does set up this different world where, again, Ripley has to go back to this hellscape again, which is so upsetting. But she does it for the right reasons. And I think once we see her getting to lead, or to a place that these people do listen to her, the movie really hits its stride.
I think so too. I want to talk about the scariest scene in the movie when, at least to me, there are a couple, but this one is always the one
that
really terrifies me. And it's when all of the Marines, when they're in the nest and we start seeing all of those xenomorphs crawling on the grates. The way that the camera moves and the way that this is edited is brilliant, I think, because we see a very quick cut to them and it is startling. It's a great jump scare. And just knowing, I think from seeing the first movie, that we really only have one that we're fighting against here, knowing that there are multiple full-sized xenomorphs is terrifying.
And it's that they have these even more humanoid characteristics, I think, like us seeing them crawling.
Yes, and how muscular they are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Like, they're very tall. I think this was modeled at one point off of someone who is 6'10". So it's human-like, but even more so to an alien extent. And yeah, that shot is awful. I mean, it's a little laughable. It's like, they weld themselves into this pod, and then they have those like plywood tiled ceilings that they didn't even think about. And that's how they're going to get it. It's like,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a little silly, but the effects of that really do work.
It's very 80s.
I'm surprised that's your scariest scene from the movie, because mine is when they're in the med lab and it's Ripley and Newt.
Yeah.
And early in the movie, we see that they're keeping these face huggers in tanks. They're studying them, and one of them is alive, and it almost like tries to reach out for somebody. Uh-huh. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, don't you understand? what this can do. The other part to that that you mentioned is that, you know, Burke is this villain that we meet immediately, but then we also meet the android, Bishop, immediately. So while that was the twist in the first movie, this is kind of building off of that. And she's like, what's an android doing here? I don't trust him. And she doesn't trust him. And I think that works in this movie's favor too. But in that med lab scene, you see the broken tanks. And you know from the scene before that Ripley put the gun on the bed on top of her. And it's now outside. So you know there's somebody meddling.
I love that too.
Right? And it just adds to how spooky the scene is. Because once you know that there are facehuggers in this room with them and they're locked in, and now Burke is turning off the camera to this room, I was nearly screaming, like shaking, just in fear for them. And the reveals in the scene, again, the editing, the effects that they have, like you seeing the facehugger crawling up behind Newt, like these are images that are just now stuck with me because of how well this movie was shot.
What about when Newt is in the water? What about that moment?
That's my favorite shot of the movie. Absolutely. And the xenomorph just popping up out of the water. It is beautifully shot. It's like some Little Mermaid moment.
Yeah, she does do kind of like a hair
flipping
flip.
Flipping her hair,
but it's
the
head. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's an alien head.
That's so funny because it is really beautiful. Because you don't... That's the other part that makes it scarier. It's like you don't think, oh, they can swim. Oh, they can... They're all of these things that make them feel completely invincible. Like, oh, how are we going to fight them? Okay, they don't like fire. But they can seemingly really go anywhere else.
And it's, at least in this movie, you know, we haven't experienced them in different environments. So you're praying that they can't swim. But when you see it pop out of the water, you're like, oh, she's done for. And I do have to admit, I had like final 20 minutes to watch. So I watched part of that bit on the train and I nearly screamed when it popped out of the water. I like was going to make a scene at 8:30
in the morning. Were you on?
It was just probably the F or the R. It was like, oh my God, I had to cover my mouth because I was just like aghast at what was happening.
Well, it really is. It's a scary moment. It's a beautiful shot, like you said. And then I think getting into the ending, where like you think the ending of Alien is intense. This one, we have in a battle between two queens, as RuPaul would say.
Two queens stand before you.
Yes, two queens stand before us. The fact that the queen gets so angry right at them for destroying her eggs... There's the motherhood theme again.
Yeah. Well, my favorite moment comes right before this, when Ripley is coming to save Newt. She finds Newt, and we see the queen alien. And for a moment, there's a wordless scene. They're just looking at each other, and Ripley has her gun, and the alien queen kind of understands what's going on. Mm-hmm. She's like, you don't kill me, I don't kill you. Because in the side wing, we have other xenomorphs coming in, ready to infiltrate and kill them. And protect the queen. So it's a brilliant way to again show the motherhood and just in protecting their young. Because Ripley now, she's like, okay, and Ripley slowly backs away. But then once the eggs start opening, she's like, sorry, bye, and starts shooting up the place.
Yeah.
And then the queen gets free. How the aliens can work elevators now, who knows? They've evolved quite rapidly in 57 years.
It's James Cameron's universe. They can do whatever they want.
I'm so dialed in at that point. I just kind of laughed. But the intensity is so high up. It also doesn't matter. It's just kind of funny. But yeah, it's a perfect ending. You know, we get this kind of fourth act again when the alien survives. And one of my just favorite near final lines of a movie. But in the beginning, we're introduced to this loader that she uses. And I think what every good, be it animated or action movie, should have like a fun ride idea built into it. You have this in like The Emperor's New Groove with like the roller coaster thing. lots of other movies. Star Wars. Star Wars, obviously, a big part of Disney World. And here you have the loader. She's yeah. like, yeah, I can work the loader. And gets into it. And she's working it. And they're shocked by her. But bringing it back in the end, and this is how she fights the alien queen. Totally ingenious. I loved it.
Mm-hmm. It's a good little Chekhov's gun detail mm-hmm. that we have. Where totally. When you're watching it and you do see it at the beginning, you clock it and you're like, this is going to come back. But the way that it comes back is great. It is so much fun seeing her in that. Again, it's just this like very powerful moment. We, you know, with everything that she's been through, it makes sense also with where the story is going. Is it too much? Probably yes, but I also don't care because it's a late 80s. It's an 80s action movie.
Yeah.
And it's the only way they can fight each other. And I do like that despite any doubts she might have had about Bishop because of her experience with Ash, he turns out to be a very different kind of android mm-hmm. who is protecting her Newt in the end in his own way too.
Which is a point that I really love in that they kind of make the audience question the entire movie is that, you know, is he going to come around and be just another company puppet that they can control? But no, he's actually on the good side and helps her. This final scene and watching Aliens, really these two, again, because I hadn't seen them before, made me realize Stranger Things is just a big ripoff of these movies.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
And that one of the characters, I forget who, wears the loader for Halloween. Mm. And I was like, oh, that's cool. But I never knew it was from Aliens.
If you want a good article about this power loader and the fight between Ripley and the Alien Queen, there's an interview for Alien's 30th anniversary back in 2016 called The Oral History of Power Loader Ripley versus the Alien Queen. So it's on Entertainment Weekly. We can link it in the episode description. It's great. They have so many details about the design and how it needed to look believable. It couldn't be something that was too unwieldy. And Cameron, who was interviewed for this, he's talking about, too, how they didn't have CGI back then. Everything was practical. So they had to think about puppets and how to fit people inside of these contraptions and how to still make it look like she could believably fight this queen. And we talked a lot about Geiger with Alien. Geiger wasn't available to work on Aliens because of scheduling conflicts. But we had Stan Winston here, who is a legend in his own right as well. He did special effects on Jurassic Park, The Thing, Edward Scissorhands, the first two Predator movies. So he's a big collaborator with James Cameron and Steven Spielberg in particular. And I think of the work here that he does, while, you know, it isn't inventing the design like an Alien, it's still pretty impressive. And especially, again, considering the constraints that they had at the time, having to make everything practical and from scratch.
But practical is why these two movies are better than any of the others. I would say Prometheus' effects are really good. And the other ones, the recent ones, do have some good effects and inventive kills that I like. But it's Alien 3 when they're using CG and Resurrection when it's like almost fully CG that takes me out.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't give you this horrific sense watching the movie of this alien because it feels like it's not really there.
Yeah, I agree. The practical effects, that makes these stand the test of time.
Again, with the film crew and production, again, they did what they could. James Cameron did have comments about the crew from England.
Of course.
That I won't say here if you do want to look that up. But he only gave the composer, so here it's James Horner, 3 weeks to work on composing and making the score. And he did some of it overnight at times. And I think the score is great, but again, this was another complicated relationship in the movie and in getting it out on time. So yeah, not great, but I think in the end, you don't see any of those complications.
No.
It's an incredible movie.
Yeah. It's the final product that counts. And with all of James Cameron's movies, you hear stories like this about it right. being a tough shoot, him not getting along with people, going over budget, going long on the schedule. But what we have is one of the great action movies and sequels. Nobody can make a sequel like James Cameron. Between Aliens and Terminator 2, he knows what he's doing with an action sequel.
The feel of this movie is really part Terminator, part Mad Max at times. I love it. I love it. So in wrapping up, if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
So I'm tempted to go visual effects again here because I do think they're stunning. But I'm going to go Best Actress for Sigourney Weaver. I want to give her that award for at least one of these movies. And I feel like what she did with Ripley, she is such an iconic character. And like I mentioned earlier, she is such a believable action hero and star while still making you believe every second of this character's emotions and feelings and motivations. And the way that I think that she is the ultimate film heroine. Like, she is one of our great women in film. She is this really adventurous character. She's practical. She has great maternal instincts and she's incredible at her job. And I feel like you have to have that sort of physical presence to make this movie work. But physical presence, you know, Weaver's height and her strength, like, that's not enough. You have to have the ability to make the audience feel something from that character too. And she absolutely does. There is that anger in her, but there's compassion for those people. And that's what makes you want to stick with her throughout the film. What about you?
I agree. My Oscar is also for Sigourney Weaver for Best Actress. I also felt like I needed to award her for one of these movies, but no, I totally think she deserves it because of how she developed the character from the first movie, of allowing us to buy into this idea of motherhood or imagining her with her family who has now passed away since she's been in hypersleep. And I think getting to live that in a different sense with Newt. And then we see her protect her and fight off all these aliens. I mean, she's doing the most and I love what she gets to do. She's totally believable. And to me, it's really these two movies where she's giving her best performances with the best script possible. But I really, truly think the most iconic ending lines that you could have, get away from her, you bitch.
Great.
Just chef's kiss.
10 out of 10.
I clapped. I actually clapped in that moment.
On the train?
And just seeing her in that loader. This was at home.
Good.
I love her for that. And she did that in one take. I don't think she was happy with it, but they had constraints, but I think it totally works.
So that was our episode on Alien and Aliens, two of the great sci-fi films of the 20th century. To wrap up, which movie do you prefer if you had to pick one?
I'm going with Aliens. There is nothing wrong with Alien, but I think the action and the intensity of Aliens is where I normally lie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising because I usually go with the first installment of any series of liking that the most, but how they built off that and continue this with one of really the most successful sequels of all time also really impressed me. So I'm going to go with Aliens. What about you? Which do you prefer?
I'm going with Alien, the first one, even though I do love Aliens and have a soft spot for it as well. Alien to me is truly a perfect movie. It is, I think, Ridley Scott's masterpiece too, and really shows that he had some creative ideas in him. I don't know what era he's in right now with Napoleon and House of Gucci. The man has high highs and low lows. I hope Gladiator 2 is great. But what he does with Alien, I think, is a complete work of science fiction filmmaking genius. Every film, like I said, since, I think, goes back to Alien as the blueprint. And I like, though, that it's not 2001, right? It's not necessarily this, like, this high concept Kubrickian work. It still has its roots in those B movies that came before, and yet the themes are brand new. It just grows for me on every single watch. So I have to go with Alien. But I like talking about both of these movies today. I'm glad that we did them as a pair in preview for Alien Romulus.
I'm curious how that movie is going to be now. I mean, we know Kaylee Spaney is leading the team. Is she, you know, the next Sigourney Weaver? I guess we'll find out.
I love Kaylee Spaney, so I'm excited to see her. The one thing that's really interesting to me is that Sigourney Weaver's 6 feet tall, and Kaylee Spaney's so tiny, so it's just going to be a very different type of heroine at the center.
Yeah.
Just in terms of physical presence, but I have faith in Kaylee Spaney. I think she can pull it off. She's a fantastic actress.
But yeah, I also had a fun time talking about these. I'm glad I finally seen them, and they're definitely worth the rewatch. So if you haven't seen them, I totally recommend seeing these before the new one or before going through the other ones. I don't know if watching them in timeline order necessarily matters. I think it's kind of fun to watch them chronologically as they were made. But let us know what you think. Thank you all for listening. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll be doing a 1954 rewind, going back 70 years, celebrating the anniversary of On the Waterfront, and that as a Best Picture winner. So we'll be talking all about Marlon Brando and Ava Marie Saint. We'll see how we feel about it as a big winner that year.
We'll be talking about workers' rights. Like you said, big, big winner, which I forget about from time to time. I know it has a reputation as being a classic film, but it won 8 Oscars. So this is a big, big winner in the history of the Academy Awards. But yeah, you know, not as action-packed as Aliens. So I'm excited to hear how you fared watching this. I actually hadn't seen it in years. I hadn't watched this since high school. So I have, I think, quite a few different opinions. I'm excited to dig into that next week. But thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at OscarWildPod. And if you really like our show, you can find bonus content at patreon.com/OscarWild.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.